Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Blue Bayou, Cop Shop, Cry Macho, and The Nowhere Inn. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring a look back at Kolchak, the Night Stalker. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The piece of news that kind of hit me hard this week is the loss of Norm Macdonald. He was best known for being on Saturday Night Live, although everyone knew who he was, but he never was a starring character because his comedy was so dry. Now, he passed away this week at age 61. He had cancer, and for the most part, he had kept it quiet, which, you know, it's funny. You have two types of people out there. You have the people that are going to live their life, and everybody knows that they get a cancer diagnosis or whatever, and that's fine. And if that's your process and that's how you communicate with the rest of the world, that's the way it goes. But then there's also people who don't want to make a public ordeal out of their diagnosis. I mean, Chadwick Boseman is a great example of that. He died of cancer, and there are a lot of people that are like, I didn't even know he was sick. And in a lot of ways, that's the same thing with Norm Macdonald. Now, Norm Macdonald was older, but still 61 is pretty young. And what's so interesting about Norm Macdonald is his dry, flat, in-your-face humor, but he doesn't have that dry humor that, you know, some people would describe like British humor as being dry, so dry that you don't even recognize that it's funny. You always knew he was making a joke, but he didn't laugh at his own jokes, which is odd because he was such good friends with Bob Saget, who laughs at all of his jokes. But talk about an independent as a comedian. A lot of people remember him from doing Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live, and he was very funny. He had some cutting commentary. He constantly made fun of O.J. Simpson, for example, and that's actually what got him fired. He kept making O.J. jokes after O.J. was acquitted, and apparently the bigwigs at NBC were like, you got to stop doing this. He's like, yeah, sure, I'll stop doing it, and he just kept doing it, and then suddenly, poof, he was gone. And he was gone so fast that I think Colin Quinn took over for him. And he was like so not prepared that first week or two because it was such a surprise. And also, Norm Macdonald went after people like Frank Stallone for being kind of a has-been, even though Frank Stallone had a certain degree of fame, but never reached the level of his brother. And he did movies. He showed up in a lot of movies and TV series, but never as a big starring role because that's not the kind of person he is. And I think he felt great comfort there. I don't think, you know, he did like Dirty Work, which is a mildly funny movie. It has its ups and downs, but I think he was comfortable being what would essentially be the sidekick in comedy or the guest star or somebody who will do stand-up. So, you know, it's sad to see him go because it was such a surprise. I always enjoyed his humor and I enjoyed him on Saturday Night Live. So rest in peace, Norm Macdonald. The next piece of news, I want to just kind of hit the box office from last week and not a lot of huge revelations. One thing that did happen is Shang-Chi did have a really good second weekend, especially for a Marvel movie. It dropped 54%. It made about $35 million, which for a regular movie, that would be kind of a hefty drop. But that's to be expected for a Marvel movie. Everything kind of drops more than 50%. The big thing where people were looking for was it going to drop as far as Black Widow? And it didn't. And that makes sense because I think Black Widow didn't have the legs that a normal movie would have because there was the at-home streaming option. You know, it's more interesting to compare it to something like Jungle Cruise, which actually, that thing just cracked $110 million this week, which is pretty good for the middling release that nobody even talks about anymore. But that's, you know, one of the highest grossing movies of the year domestically. So Shang-Chi did well, and that's fantastic. You know, Free Guy broke $100 million last weekend. That's fantastic. But here's the thing. A lot of people have been heaping the praise on Shang-Chi and Free Guy and saying, oh, movies are back. Isn't it great? Theaters are back. But they kind of aren't. You have these couple towers in the field. You know, you've got these movies that have done very well. You know, Disney and Universal to a degree, because they had F9 come out earlier this year, and they also had Candyman that did quite well and old. You know, they figured out how to do the 17-day window. And I think that's what has helped Universal out. I think Disney's figured it out. But a lot of these other releases that are coming out aren't doing well. Malignant didn't even make $5.5 million. It made less than Free Guy did in its fifth weekend. But Malignant got a lot of buzz online. Everybody was talking about it because everybody watched it at home. But you have other stuff. You know, the top five movies, with the exception of Malignant, it's Universal and Disney. And three of them are Disney because you got to count Free Guy in there. But really, you know, Card Counter came out last week. That barely made $1 million. I mean, it's just, these are not money makers. And even like the limited stuff, you know, something like I talked about last week, Language Lessons, that I think did okay in its limited release. It was only in 44 theaters, but it did not make much money, partly because that's not a movie that requires the big screen. A little bit more about that later. But I think the hybrid releases coming out in October are going to have a little bit of say, see what happens with the Addams Family and see what happens with the Halloween Kills. And along with Dune being a Warner Brothers movie, Disney has committed to a theatrical window for the rest of 2021. But, you know, gosh knows what happens they're going to do next year. They may restructure the direct delivery and they make, I wouldn't be surprised if you start seeing some murky announcements where they're not committing how they're going to release it until later. But October's going to be telling with James Bond and Dune and Venom, which I don't know even what's happening there. And Halloween is a hybrid, but I think that's a smart idea. I think that's got 2 weeks to capitalize on the Halloween name. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Hawkeye, which is coming to Disney Plus on November 24th.
Authorities are wondering if the masked vigilante who terrorized the city's underworld is back.
The past is caught up with me.
Should we be worried?
No, it's nothing. I'll be home for Christmas.
When I wore this suit, I made a whole lot of enemies.
You're Hawkeye!
Who the hell are you?
Some people have actually called me the world's greatest archer.
Are you one of those people?
This is, of course, the latest in the Disney live action series. It looks like Hawkeye's taking a little more typical Marvel whimsical approach, and this looks pretty good. I think it's great that he's getting a series that they can develop his character, because he's always an afterthought in everything. Even his character, what they did with him in Endgame, where he loses his family and he goes crazy. He's still kind of an afterthought in that movie. He had a very minor part in that film. So I'm looking forward to Hawkeye. I think that one's going to be interesting to watch on Disney+. The next one I want to talk about is Ron's Gone Wrong, and that is in theaters on October 22nd.
I got what you want.
Dad, you got me one.
Welcome to the show. Hi, Barney. I'm your best friend out of my box.
What are you doing?
Barney, your Bebop is, like, super weird.
Okay, Ron, a bunch of your code is missing.
Move!
You're supposed to know everything about me.
Making friends is what he's for.
Friend request? Friend request.
If he can't do that, he's, like, literally pointless.
This is a Fox animated film, but since it's now owned by Disney, it's technically a Disney film, but they're releasing it under the 20th Century banner. I mean, it might be a fun movie. Mitchell versus the Machines, I think, did this so well that I don't even think Ron's Gone Wrong is going to come close to achieving what the Mitchells versus the Machines have done in terms of, you know, commentary about kids and technology. The other thing is, this does look like it's trying to walk that tightrope between condemning technology and embracing technology, not wanting to alienate your audience who's really into likes and stuff, but also trying to give the actual better message of be yourself. Because if you be yourself, you don't get all the likes. You have to play to an audience to get the most likes. And that's not something we should be teaching our kids, but those messages always get mixed up. And I have a feeling it's going to tell a whimsical little story. And as it tries to get a message, it's going to kind of collapse under its own weight, which is kind of what Wreck-It Ralph 2 did. So that's my worry about this film. I don't know. It's up in the air. It may not be very good. Anyways, that's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Blue Bayou. back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about Blue Bayou. A Louisiana man faces deportation when he discovers his adoption as a child never granted him citizenship.
I posted bail. He should have been out by now.
He's not here anymore. ICE took him.
What?
I just don't understand how they can deport him.
I was brought here when I was 3.
Can't we do something about this? I mean, listen to him. Look at him. He's American.
ICE is targeting people like you, adopted or not.
I've been here for over 30 years.
You also have a criminal record.
Are we getting kicked out?
Nah, baby girl.
He's Korean. He's not Korean-American because he's not an American citizen, even though he basically the version of a dreamer or DACA. He's somebody who was brought here as a child through no means of his own and never got citizenship in that way. Only it's very different than when most people consider DACA, as they consider people from the southern countries, you know, places like Mexico and elsewhere in South and Central America. And his whole thing is he's like, he's married. He's got a kid on the way. He had gone through foster care and adoption and they didn't do it right. And it's bringing up the point, and it becomes very clear at least halfway through the movie that the point of this movie is to put a spotlight on American immigration policy that can be considered cruel. You know, you got to have a certain level of sympathy for people if they were brought here when they were 3. I mean, they're literally carried here. It's not their fault that they didn't do this. And if they just happen to be a loophole, there should be a better way for keeping them around. But here's the problem with this movie is they lay everything on so thick. It's not just an average person. Like, you know, there's people in my kid's high school who are dreamers, or they're people who were not born here, but they've lived here all their life. And they keep their nose clean. They're not in trouble with the law or anything like that. They're typical American kids, only they're technically not American. Those people get a lot of sympathy and a focus. The problem with this movie is the guy is, he's got a criminal record. He's good at mechanic works. And at the beginning of the movie, he's trying to get a job as a mechanic with motorcycles, but he's got a history of stealing motorcycles. So no one wants to hire this guy. And it makes sense. Then, of course, his wife, who's played by Alicia Vikander, is pregnant with his kid, but her ex-husband he's a cop in Louisiana, this small town, and this is kind of what starts the ball rolling in the realization. The problem with this movie is it lays it on so thick, and at every turn, there's a reason why it's a problem for him. Oh, he's got a criminal record. And at a certain point, I'm just getting exhausted letting the movie make excuses for this guy. Part of the other thing that they do in here, and this is sort of this bait and switch with his character, he's got all this baggage and negative elements in his life, but they make him then this perfect father, this perfect guy, very, very nice, always polite, always caring for his wife and his stepdaughter and all these things that happen in his life. But no one's ever that perfect. It doesn't show his bad side. And the only time you see his bad side is when he's like, oh, I'm just in such a struggle because I need money, so I'll help somebody do some robberies just to make the money so I can pay my immigration lawyer. And I don't know. I think that those are cop-outs in terms of character elements. Look, if you are an undocumented or non-legal immigrant in this country and you're keeping your nose clean, you're doing everything, I have a lot of sympathy for it, and I think there should be a working to help you out. But if you've got a bad history and you've got criminal past, talking about if you're like in a gang membership, if you've been in jail for robbery or theft or violence or something like that, that kind of stuff, I don't have a lot of sympathy. But so he has all this baggage, but you don't see any of the actual effects of that. Plus, it just drags on and on and on. It just keeps going, and it's boring, and it's just all these people talking, and they just drag every scene out. And I'm like, oh God, is this thing over? And I look at my watch. I'm like, oh my God, it's not even half over. It was the most boring movie ever. I have all the sympathy for the people that this movie is about in real life, but no, not in this incredibly pretentious, overdone, overwrought format. So I'm going to have to say Blue Bayou sucks.
It sucks.
Now, interesting thing with Blue Bayou, I just want to address something here. This was a movie that they would not provide a screener for. You know, we are still in the middle of a pandemic, so it's out there. And even if you're vaccinated, there's still infection risks with the very contagious Delta variant. And so I understand if there's a lot of people, especially film critics, who don't particularly want to go to a screening like this. Now, I don't mind going to a screening. I've been to several press screenings where there's a dozen people there, we're all spread out. But I don't particularly like going to a screening that's packed with people. Like the guy behind me, he was coughing the whole time while he's mowing popcorn. The woman in front of me was coughing the whole time. She had a mask, and it sounded like it might have been a smoker's hack. But, you know, in this day and age, you can't say cough or do any sort of coughing and not have people freak out. And I don't know why the guy behind me was coughing, whether he had a summer cold or if he was just shoveling so much popcorn in his mouth, the debris and kernels got caught in his throat. But still, I didn't want to be there for that. And I'm watching this movie. I'm like, there is not a single reason I need to see this in a theater. And that's the crux. That's not just for my own personal thing of saying to a studio, I'd like a screener for this so I can watch it on my own time in my own limited space and control my environment. But I'm watching this film like, this is why these movies aren't doing well in the box office. There's not a iota of this film that requires it to be on the big screen. It's a kitchen sink melodrama. There's no big action. There's no big sound effects. There's no amazing cinematography. There's no reason you need to see this in a theater. Zero, zilch, whatsoever. It is as effective or ineffective on the small screen in the comfort of your own home as it is in the theater. And then these are the movies that are going to be suffering. And they're the ones suffering now. Even though IFC had a burgeoning career last year because they took advantage of drive-ins. But, you know, a small little intimate movie like this isn't going to make anything in the theatrical box office. It might find an audience at home, but that begs the question of this theatrical experience. How important is this theatrical experience? And don't get me wrong, I have great memories of growing up and watching movies in movie theaters, but usually those memories aren't about the movie theater. They're about the people I went to the movies with. And I had a friend online who actually is Canadian, but he used a term. He says, we need to get beyond the fetishization of the theatrical experience. And he's absolutely right. Yes, if it's pristine and it's perfect and it's an IMAX movie and it's there, but really IMAX isn't always will be a level of niche, but your average movie doesn't need to be seen on the big screen. And I think that's playing out in the marketplace in a lot of ways. And I don't think that's going to go away. And in fact, as home systems get better and better, and everybody upgraded this year because of the pandemic. I mean, I hear this whole thing about you need to be out in the theaters and it does have an experience. Nah, it doesn't. There's a couple movies can say the theater enhance the experience, but a lot of them, no, I have just as good of an experience watching it at home. And I think there's a lot of people that are like that. And when you're releasing movies like Blue Bayou, and we're heading into award season, people, they're going to be releasing a bunch of these things. There's another movie this week that I was supposed to get a screener of, and they're just dragging their feet on screeners. So I'm not covering it this week. Tough beans, man. And there's another thing with the quote-unquote theatrical experience. There's a newness factor that people want. We had that with the Avengers films and then Star Wars. Because remember in 2015 when The Force Awakens came out, everyone's like, I need to see it the opening week or it's going to get spoiled. And both of those came to an end in 2019, just coincidentally, right before the pandemic. There's no movie out there really right now or even any of them coming up that I'm like, I have to see within the first 45 days. We are changing and this is more an examination of people's viewing habits that's been going this way for the last 10 years anyways. It's been masked in a lot of ways. But now, you know, the pandemic has pulled that mask off and revealed it. That's not a great analogy because the pandemic didn't pull the mask off of anybody. But anyways, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Cry Macho and Cop Shop. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Cry Macho. Clint Eastwood plays a man who travels to Mexico to bring a troubled teen home to his father.
You owe me, Mike. You gave me your word. And that used to mean something. My son, Rafael, he's in trouble. I want to get him out of Mexico.
You want me to go down there and kidnap him?
Please. Just getting back up here.
You used to be strong. Macho.
I used to be a lot of things. But I'm not now.
This macho thing is overrated.
First of all, can I just say how amazing it is that Clint Eastwood is still directing and starring in movies at age 91? I mean, he is certainly showing his age. I mean, he was showing his age over the last 15 or 20 years, even stuff like Million Dollar Baby and Gran Torino. But yeah, he certainly is showing his age. He's looking old in this movie, and he is. He's 91. But you know, God bless him for continuing doing the work. But this is based on a book, and I've not read the book, but apparently the book was supposed to be a movie, and then it was changed into a novel when it didn't get made, and they've been trying literally to make this movie for decades, going back to having Clint Eastwood star in it back in the 80s or 90s, and Arnold Schwarzenegger was going to be in it at one point, and they flopped around all over the place, and it finally got made. And it's about a rodeo star who had gotten injured, and then he had some family issues, and this ranch owner who he's worked with, he kind of owes him for helping him out. And so he agrees to go down to Mexico and get this kid. Now, the whole thing is the mother's kind of, she's got money, but she's a terrible mom. And the father's not a great father either, because his kid has been gone since he was 6 years old. So that is not exact. You know, he's not father of the year. Neither of the parents are going to win parent of the year. So he finds this kid in Mexico City, which, I mean, from the book takes place in Galveston, Texas. I looked up, and he goes down to Mexico City, which is like a 20-hour drive now. And so I can't imagine what it would have been back in the 70s when this takes place. But he goes back down there and he convinces the kid to come back with him. And over their long journey back to Texas, he's bonding with the kid. He's learning, you know, who he is and why he's has some problems and what it's like to live with the mother and his relationship with his father. And of course they bond, and Clint's character had lost his family in a car accident. So there's that missing child element that works together with that. And ultimately, when you break it down, it's a movie about this relationship between this guy and this kid. And then they get stuck in this small town and kind of have to just live there for at least a couple weeks as they're trying to avoid the federales who have been set on their tails and the bounty hunters who are working for the mom to bring them back. And that's really where the essence of the movie is, where they settle in a town, which is a very Western type of movie setup anyways. And there's a woman who runs this restaurant, and she's got grandkids because her daughter had died. And so they start bonding with her, and all the people in the town seem to like him. And he's a gentle man, but he's rugged and he's got grit. And the kid's Rooster, because the kid would get into cockfighting, so he has a rooster, and he named the rooster Macho. And of course, the kid's focusing on macho, macho, macho. You're strong, you got to be good. And there's this bit, and it's actually in the trailer, but there's this whole bit in near the end of the movie where he talks about saying, well, you know, macho isn't always the best thing. You know, some guys are out there trying to be macho, and you make stupid decisions. And I think that's part of it is Clint answering for his tough guy persona that he's had for so many years, and acknowledging, and I don't know if this monologue comes from the book or not, but it certainly feels like it's Clint acknowledging the fact that machismo, when it's just slathered on as a coat you're wearing, doesn't work. I mean, if you're somebody who's, you know, salt of the earth, and you've got grit, and you've worked on the farm or a ranch, and you've got that, yeah, you're macho, but that's just kind of like how you developed, but this sort of posturing that goes on with macho. If you're somebody who wears cowboy boots and drives a big truck and has a cowboy hat and, you know, walks around and treats women like crap just because that's what you think macho is, it's not. You know, being a good person is different. And you see the softer side of the character in here, where he's, you know, he sort of becomes the village vet. Even he doesn't have a license or anything, but he has been around animals all his life, and he's kind to animals, and he's, you know, helps them out or whatever, because it shows a softer side to him. And I think that's an important message to make. Now, the movie itself, I mean, it's a good movie. Clint's movies tend to either they're overblown and they talk too much and they go down paths and they don't have good characters, or they're really, really good. And this one, it's much more intimate and it's smaller. And I have to say, I really enjoyed it. The relationship between him and the kid is probably the strongest one you've got there. So, I mean, it works. Now, the thing that's so weird about it is I looked up the budget. This movie cost $33 million to make. And that's where I'm like, maybe this is the problem with Hollywood. Maybe this is the problem with the distribution system we have. because $30 million, $33 million, I don't know where that money went, because you certainly don't see it on the screen. Unless they paid $15 million to Clint Eastwood and $5 million to Dwight Yoakam to play the dad. Because outside of the two of them, there's nobody of any note in the movie. There's no names. Yeah, I mean, they're good actors, but you're not paying for some star to be in the movie. And while it looks nice and it's got all these nice Western vistas and everything, it's not exactly using brand new technology to shoot it. I mean, you're shooting vistas that we've been shooting in Westerns for dozens of years. And all the locations are small villages. There's like maybe 5-10 minutes of screen time devoted to locations that are nice. They're like the ranch's house and then the woman's in Mexico City. And like I said, 10 minutes tops, it's time spent there. And the rest of it, they're either camping, they're in a car on the road, and it's not even having to work on vintage stuff because it's just the desert and it's these ramshackled buildings in these villages. You could have made this movie for $10 million and gotten the exact same movie. And then maybe it would make sense to release it as a hybrid release in theaters on an HBO Max. And so it's not just we're making $300 million James Bond movies. We're making $30 million intimate Western movies that could probably cost a couple million. Yeah, that's either neither here nor there to the enjoyment of the movie. Because overall, I'm going to say that Cry Macho kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Cop Shop. Frank Grillo stars as a man who gets into a small-town jail in Nevada in an attempt to escape killers coming after him.
So why were you looking to get locked up, Theodore?
Everyone's trying to kill me.
What'd you do?
I did what I had to do.
To get to you, Teddy.
The legendary Bob Vittick.
You're a psychopath.
I'm a professional. I'm gonna kill you.
Drop that gun. No one kills anyone in here.
Now this, unlike Cry Macho, which is a very typical Western and typical locations, this is one of those modern Westerns where they take an old-fashioned Western idea and then put it in a modern setting. And Frank Grillo is running from somebody and he gets put in this jail and he's trying to save himself from the bad guys coming after him. And Gerard Butler's this hitman who's coming after him and gets put in the jail as well. It's a nice modern police station in the middle of the desert in Nevada, and Alexis Lauder plays one of the deputies there, and she's the one who is sort of like the focus on it. And she does actually a really good job as kind of holding it together as the good guy, as the police officer who's trying to keep law and order and figure out what's going on, because, of course, more assassins are coming after this character played by Frank Grillo. And of course, it leads to all the elements you'd guess for the Western, you know, the siege on the jail and the attack and the shoot 'em up. And there's lots of destruction and gunplay. And I don't know what the budget on this one was, but at least I could believe it, them spending $30 million on making all the explosions. But I think this is a low budget film that is directed by Joe Carnahan. And he had done big ones like The A-Team and he did Smoke and Aces, but he also cut his teeth on stuff like Narc. I gotta say, I enjoyed this movie. I thought it was about what it needed to be. I mean, I'm not gonna overstate what it is. It's still just a low-budget action movie, but it works for what it is. It's not trying to be anything more, and it's nice to see Gerard Butler doing some fun stuff again. So I'm gonna have to say that Cop Shop kind of rocks as well.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm gonna be talking about the Nowhere Inn and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Kolchak, the Night Stalker. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the final film in the review line, and that is The Nowhere Inn. Indie rock star St. Vincent hires her best friend to make a documentary about her upcoming tour, but things go off the rails when she is pushed to enhance her offstage persona.
It was supposed to be a music documentary, concert footage, interviews, you know. I wanted people to know who I really am, so
I asked my best friend to direct it.
We're gonna film everything. Just be yourself.
I love you!
You're nerdy.
pretty and normal in real life, but the disparity between that and who you are on stage is jarring.
I can be St. Vincent all the time so that I can be a little bit more interesting.
I've not listened to St. Vincent. I'm not a fan of her music. I really couldn't recognize a song. If you played, maybe if you played one of the songs that was in the film that I watched, I might recognize it. But otherwise, I just don't listen to her. So it was interesting coming to this movie as somebody who knows nothing about her, or not even somebody who'd recognize her music. Her real name is Annie Clark, and she has a sort of indie music, and she has a big following. But the character of St. Vincent is that onstage performer, sort of like Ziggy Stardust was for David Bowie. I mean, there is a performance art to her show. And in real life, she's best friends or really good friends with Carrie Brownstein. And people recognize her from the TV show Portlandia, that she did the sketch series she did on IFC with Fred Armisen. They just wrapped it up the last season a couple years ago. And it's very Portland, but it's oftentimes centered on just directly to Portland jokes. You have to have an understanding of Portland, Oregon. Not Maine, but Portland, Oregon, to understand at least some of the jokes. And it has the hippy dippy jokes in it. You know, it makes fun of the right and the left because there's the ultra left in Portland. And, you know, Portlandia, it pokes fun at everybody in the city. And that was sort of this surreal sketch comedy series. Annie Clark actually showed up, or St. Vincent showed up in a couple episodes. But Carrie Brownstein herself is a filmmaker and a director and a writer, and so she got her to shoot this documentary. Well, she got in the story is about her getting it. They both play versions of themselves, fictional versions of themselves. And as Carrie's shooting this movie, the behind the scenes of St. Vincent, of Annie Clark, just as a normal person, she's just kind of just a boring person. I mean, I'm not saying she's a boring person, but she doesn't live an exciting life. Yeah, she's a rock star, but she'll sit there and play video games or be playing Scrabble with one of the guys on her road crew. And that's it. It's not the big party bus that you expect. You know, people say, what's a rock star's life like when they're touring? And yeah, when you have the big tours and you want to go back to the big days of, you know, Kiss in the 70s. Yeah, there were the big parties. But, you know, for a musician like this, who I don't know how often she tours, but I imagine like a lot of modern musicians, she's got to tour a good chunk of the year to kind of promote herself. You know, it's exhausting. You go in, you get to a new city, you move into wherever you're staying, and then you have to do sound checks and you do rehearsals, you make sure everything works. And then you do the show and you just want to go home and lay around in your sweats and read a book sometimes. You know, that's the way a lot of people really are. And in the movie, Carrie Brownstein's character is like, you know, this is not exciting. This isn't, nobody's going to care about this. Can we kind of just make it a little bit better? And so it's about her then letting the stage persona take over her personal life. And then it starts really kind of chipping away at reality and it gets very surreal. You know, I wouldn't say David Lynchian, although it steps its toes into that area, but it's very much like Portlandia where it at times is surreal and hyper real at times. And you know, it's not a real documentary because it is going so far off the rails. So it is kind of a neat movie to watch because if you've seen enough of these films about reality falling apart around you, it fits into that category. It starts out as a rockumentary, you know, it starts out as a music documentary or a concert film, kind of the two, but then it sort of turns, I wouldn't say it's a horror movie, but it's, you know, it's a surrealist piece of fiction that they go over the top and you see these slices of their interactions with each other and, you know, looks at the subject of persona and what your onstage presence is and what fame does to you and how it brings you an audience, but it also alienates you and how tough it is actually to tour. It's not just one big party. And that kind of shows, you know, backstage pass to one of Annie Clark's shows probably isn't all that exciting as much as it would have to get a backstage pass to Metallica in the 80s. Who knows? So I found it interesting because I thought it was revealing, but I thought it was very interesting in that surreal way they deconstruct all these elements of fame and what it can do to you personally. So I'm going to have to say that The Nowhere Inn rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on an old television show, actually, and it's me getting ready for October. As you know, on October, I always like to watch horror movies and horror-themed stuff. And one series that, you know, it's funny, I never watched it as a kid because I guess I just never stumbled upon it or knew where it was airing on the rerun schedule. It was out in 1975. And that is Kolchak the Night Stalker. This 1970 TV series follows an investigative journalist who looks into the claims of the incredible and the paranormal.
My name is Kolchak of the Daily Chronicle.
Kolchak reports the bizarre, the supernatural, the unexplainable.
You again in another crazy story.
This nut thinks he is a vampire. He has killed four, maybe five women.
They don't want any help from amateur bloodhounds like you.
I've been a reporter for 22 years.
I've been a police officer for 30.
Well, then why don't you retire?
Darren McGavin, the Night Stalker.
One of the things that brought Kolchak back into the pop culture light was in the 90s, when The X-Files was becoming one of the biggest hits on the planet, Chris Carter, and more specifically Frank Spaniff, who was one of the producers and writers for it, they talked about how influenced they were by this series. I mean, it's very different than The X-Files. The X-Files is this very rigid FBI examination, whereas Kolchak, the character of Carl Kolchak, he was just this dumpy, floppy guy. He's played by Darren McGavin, and most people will recognize him as the dad from A Christmas Story. Now, way back early in his career, he played Mickey Spillane's Mike Hammer at one point. But once he got to be a little older, he stopped being the hard-boiled detective and then became kind of the frumpy, sloppy guy, you know, just the bumbling guy. And he wears this bad suit. It's this sky blue suit or this ice cream colored suit. And he's got this goofy hat that he would wear. And he's your typical beat reporter. And he's running around trying to catch stories. Now, it's funny, when the series starts, it launches right into it with sort of the supernatural paranormal elements. But it takes several episodes to really get their footing. And the writing is, let's just say the writing is not atypical of TV writing in the 70s, which means it wasn't super well crafted. And this was a throwaway show. It got one season on NBC. It was more remembered fondly because of some of the over-the-top insane things that they did. But by the time you get to episode 4 or 5, the episode's called The Vampire, and it's about a woman who's a call girl from Las Vegas who is a vampire who then kills her clients, and it's Kolchak trying to track her down, and she's visiting Los Angeles. I don't know why you go to Los Angeles or Las Vegas if you're a vampire. There's a lot of sun out there, you know. Then there's another one where there's a werewolf on a cruise ship, which is over the top. That's when it really starts getting good, because it starts out that he's just this beat reporter and just gets these dumb assignments, but now he's kind of turned into the guy who investigates the weird stuff. You know, he's not going to do obituaries and court reports. He goes after the crazy stories. And he just kind of fumbles around and is an absolute doofus a lot of ways. And none of it has any sort of credibility behind it, but it is funny and goofy and silly. And at the time when they were making stuff like Starsky and Hutch, you know, you had a series like this that was playing around in the background. And this is a lot of fun. Now, if you've not seen it, the best way to check it out is you can get the NBC app on Apple TV or Roku or anywhere. And there's a lot of content actually on those, you know, just NBC. I think some of them you have to have a cable subscription to watch some shows, but not this one. This one you can watch for free. It has a bunch of ads embedded in it. But then again, if you ever watched it as a kid, you would have. But it's on the NBC app. And as I understand it, the whole series, you can watch the whole first season. That's all there is. You can watch that for free. And it's a lot of fun. It's a great little background noise Halloween type TV series that gives a little bit of nostalgia and a little bit of fun. So I'm going to have to say that Kolchak the Night Stalker rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Available for new this week, you've got Black Widow and Zola and The Human Factor, as well as Boss Baby, Family Business. Vintage releases, you've got Kubo and the Two Strings and Paranorman. Both are coming out from Leica in a special edition. And then Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters and The Shawshank Redemption are both in 4K. And then finally, for those who want to check some TV, you've got Mayor of Easttown, the complete first season, available if you don't have HBO Max. And that's it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Foundation, Star Wars Visions, and Creepshow Season 3. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.